Welcome, everybody. We'll get started. We've got an action-packed day today, and Dean has urged me to keep us going and staying on time. Welcome to the Federalist Society's second annual Executive Branch Review Conference. Today, we will hear from experts who will discuss some of the most important questions facing America today. Are we really a society governed by laws and not men? Has the balance of power tipped from the Congress and the judiciary to the president, and has it tipped too far? How secure are our basic freedoms and fundamental liberties as American citizens? Often we've heard President Obama say that he has two tools, a pen and a phone. You know, for a former law professor, he seems to have missed some major parts of the Constitution there. But just this week, we saw the White House roll out its climate change initiative, stressing that in spite of opposition from Congress, the president's going to direct EPA to go it alone with onerous new regulatory burdens on carbon energy. Now, one suspects that all this bluster has more to do with the president's poll numbers being in the tank than policy. You know, with that type of approval ratings, the presidents feel we have to do something. And this president seems to have a tough time showing that he can do something in Russia or do something about the economy or even health care. And so the Obama administration decided it's time to pick on coal and oil and natural gas. The problem is that rhetoric has consequences. And the precedent set by the president directing executive agencies to use powers that arguably they don't have does lasting damage to our constitutional system of government. Today's conference has been put together by the Federalist Society's attorney practice groups. Thank you for all the hard work on that. And our goal is to dissect that question and put together ideas for how to make our polity better. To kick us off is a member of Congress who understands this very well. He learned constitutional law in spite of going to Harvard Law School. He's served our country nobly in battle as an infantryman and in battle as a member of Congress from the 4th District in Arkansas. For some unknown reason, he's decided that he should continue to serve in the United States Senate. Thank you for offering yourself up as a candidate. So please, without further ado, let us welcome a Federalist Society member, Congressman Tom Cotton.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. It's an honor to be here with you this morning at the Executive Branch Review Conference talking about executive overreach, which is what we would call in the Army a target-rich environment these days. To kick it off, I want to speak at a general level about the Constitution. It's a document that I take seriously. I swore an oath to it, not just as a congressman, but when the stakes were really high as a soldier. Unfortunately, I can't judge that Barack Obama takes the Constitution quite so seriously. In fact, today I want to discuss the anti-constitutional excesses of the Obama administration. Now, you might say, why the unusual phrasing? Why anti? Why not unconstitutional, which is more common? Well, let me explain. The prefix un simply means not. An action or law is unconstitutional. That means it's simply not constitutional. The prefix anti, though, means opposed to or hostile to. And this term, I think, better captures our president, the spirit of his administration, and in fact, the spirit of modern liberalism. The proposition that Barack Obama is an anti-constitutionalist is perhaps controversial. So let me offer the best evidence, his own words. The fundamental truth is Barack Obama rejects fundamental truth. President Obama writes in The Audacity of Hope, quote, implicit in the very idea of ordered liberty is a rejection of absolute truth. Those are his own words in his own hand, the rejection of absolute truth. Does our president not know that our country is founded on absolute truth, on self-evident truth, the self-evident truths that all men are created equal and we are endowed by our Creator with certain rights, such as the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? If the president is right and there's no absolute truth, then there is no liberty. At least there's no fixed moral basis for liberty. And this is not an abstract point. This is a fundamental difference. As Jefferson said, Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? If we reject absolute truth, that all men are created equal, then we deny the special status of America. Again, in his own words, that's what Barack Obama does when he says he believes in American exceptionalism, but only in the way that the British believe in British exceptionalism, or the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism, all of which is to say a kind of childish chauvinism for one's own land, indifferent to the moral principle of that land. Barack Obama's anti-constitutionalist attitude, then, should come as little surprise, since he denies the moral foundation of our governing charter. The Constitution is, after all, the frame of silver to the Declaration's apple of gold, to use Lincoln's imagery. The Constitution adorns, embodies, and guards the Declaration's principles. In fact, it foreshadows the Constitution's structure. The constitutional design rests on three basic principles of governmental power. First, power should be limited to preserve the liberty of man. As Reagan said, man is not free unless government is limited. That's why the powers of the federal government are enumerated and limited in our Constitution. Second, power should be representative. Regular elections not only provide consent of the governed, but are the chief mechanism to preserve the limits of power, what Madison said called the primary control on the government. Third, power should be separated. Elections are the external means to control the government, but the separation of powers is the internal mechanism to keep the government limited, what Madison called inventions of prudence or auxiliary precautions. You find all three of these ideas in the Declaration's Bill of Particulars against King George III. The many indictments against him boil down to his violating the ideas of representation, separation of powers, and limited government. This essential unity between the Declaration and the Constitution means that you can't have one without the other, or at least one can't survive without the other. And if you reject the premise of the Declaration, as President Obama does, then you naturally develop anti-constitutionalist tendencies. Again, let's consider some of his own words. A couple of years ago, it was reported that the president was lamenting how much easier it would be to be president of China. Well, there's no doubt about that. It would be much easier not have to deal with pesky elections and the people's representatives and independent judiciary and equal citizens with individual rights. Of course, no sentiment could be further divorced from our first president, who had the opportunity to be a king but instead returned to his farm. Of a piece with this sentiment is the president's oft-stated promise or threat that if Congress won't act, I will. Or, as the focus groups tell him to say now, I have a pen and a phone. President Obama isn't talking about the conduct of war or diplomacy, although it would be nice if he paid more attention to those critical matters. Rather, he's indicating his intent to violate the separation of powers, to do by executive fiat that which he cannot accomplish through Congress. Maybe he really does want to be the president of China instead of the president of the United States. These words matter. The president's words betray his anti-constitutionalist attitude. But actions matter too. His own actions, his bureaucracy's actions, his signature legislation. The picture only gets worse when we consider those actions. Consider the actions that are his alone, like appointments. In January 2012, President Obama purported to make so-called recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, even while the Senate remained in pro forma session, even while the Senate passed significant legislation during that session. Unfortunately, presidents of both parties have abused the recess appointment power for decades, but none have taken it so far. In fact, the practice of keeping the Senate in pro forma session to prevent recess appointments dates only to the final years of George W. Bush's presidency, and President Bush respected it, making no more appointments. Not so with Barack Obama, whose lawless actions have been ruled unconstitutional by two different courts. In its unanimous opinion vacating an action taken by the president's recess appointees, the D.C. Circuit noted that adopting the administration's position and, quote, allowing the president to define the scope of his own appointments power would eviscerate the Constitution's separations of power. Also noted that it would demolish the checks and balances inherent in the advice and consent requirement and emphatically stated this cannot be the law. This case is now pending at the Supreme Court, where I expect the administration will be handed a similarly stinging rebuke within a matter of weeks. By the same token, take President Obama's refusal to defend the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act. In certain extraordinary cases, of course, it's appropriate for the executive branch not to defend plainly unconstitutional laws when no reasonable argument can be made for them. Yet not only can reasonable arguments be made for DOMA, the Department of Justice previously had defended it in both the Bush and the Clinton administrations. For President Obama, though, that was politically inexpedient, despite his constitutional responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And he doesn't just limit himself to selectively defending the law. Sometimes he creates his own enforcement standards from whole cloth. Consider, for instance, his so-called deferred action immigration policy, which exempts from potential deportation nearly 2 million illegal immigrants who claim to have been minors when they entered the United States. This policy, remember, came in response to a Democratic Congress's refusal to pass the so-called DREAM Act. Now, one step removed from the president's own personal actions are those of his regulatory agencies, where we see this anti-constitutionalist spirit spread throughout the government by the people he appoints to run these agencies and implement his policies. Under Obamacare, for instance, the Department of Health and Human Services mandated that employers provide insurance coverage for abortifacients. After intense political pressure and several lawsuits, the administration shifted the mandate to insurance companies. But employers still subsidize that coverage, and that shift does nothing for self-insured groups. That's why the Conference of Catholic Bishops still opposes the mandate. You don't have to be Catholic or even pro-life to see that this kind of violation of the First Amendment imperils religious freedom for us all. And now, of course, we know that HHS is no saint when it comes to dependably implementing other parts of Obamacare either. The employer mandate, twice delayed. The individual policy's minimum coverage requirements, twice delayed. The individual mandate to purchase coverage, effectively delayed. The list goes on, but you get the point. This kind of flagrant disregard for our constitutional system is all too common throughout the bureaucracy. Earlier this year, for example, the Departments of Treasury and Justice issued guidance to banks on how to effectively provide financial services to marijuana dealers. You really can't make it up. The administration is now counseling the aiding and abetting of a federal felony. To cite another example, President Obama's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission sued a Lutheran church for employment discrimination after the church dismissed a minister for insubordination. The EEOC contended that the government should be able to second-guess a church's decision of who ministers to the faithful, despite the guarantees of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court unanimously rejected this theory, calling it extreme, remarkable, and untenable, but it's standard operating procedure in the Obama administration. In a case that hits a little closer to home for me, the administration was also unanimously defeated in Arkansas Game and Fish Commission versus the United States. In that case, the administration argued that they could temporarily flood someone's land with impunity without ever having to pay compensation under the Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause. Again, the court ruled unanimously and said the administration's position had no solid grounding in precedent. These are just two examples of the 25 times the Supreme Court has unanimously rejected the Obama administration's position. And there's only one reason for all of those 9-0 decisions, by the way. It's because the Supreme Court doesn't have 11 justices. Finally, let's consider the president's landmark laws, starting, of course, with his namesake, Obamacare. Well, where can we begin? One major element of the law, the mandatory state expansion of Medicaid, was struck down by the Supreme Court, which called it a kind of economic, unconstitutional dragooning of the states. Regrettably and wrongly, in my opinion, the court contorted itself to uphold the individual mandate, but only as a tax, which, of course, the president had repeatedly insisted during the legislative debates that it was not. Obamacare also creates an unaccountable Medicare rationing panel called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Incredibly, the law purports to limit Congress's power to repeal or modify the IPAB to 1 7-month period in 2017, and only then by a 3/5 majority of both houses. If that window is missed, Obamacare purports to forbid Congress from ever altering another IPAB proposal. No Congress, though, can limit the power of a future Congress, and such attempts to, in effect, amend our Constitution by statute are anti-constitutional to the core. Perhaps the only rival to Obamacare in this assault on the Constitution is the Dodd-Frank law, which also created the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Dodd-Frank empowers the CFPB unlimited authority to regulate practices it deems abusive or even unfair. It also eliminates Congress's power of the purse by funding CFPB through the Federal Reserve fees, and it allows the director of the CFPB to decide unilaterally how many of those fees he will draw. And the law severely restricts judicial review of CFPB decisions. It's hard to imagine a worse constitutional monstrosity. Competing with it, though, is another entity from that law, the Financial Stability Oversight Council. This new interagency council has unlimited power to designate any financial institution to be, quote, systemically important, too big to fail, based on criteria of its own making, giving those institutions a competitive advantage of an explicit government guarantee. Moreover, the designation is completely insulated from meaningful judicial review. But don't worry, when all this comes a cropper, the law also provides for something called the Orderly Liquidation Authority, an ironically named government power if there ever was one, since a liquidation will be anything but orderly under this power. Actually, financial regulators can do far more than simply wind down a company, even one that's solvent. They can merge it, sell it, transfer its assets, repudiate its contracts, and discriminate among its creditors. The law also mandates that the process be conducted in secret and severely limits the target company's right to judicial review, which must then conclude within 24 hours. What's worse, creditors get no notice and no right of judicial review, depriving them of due process and taking their property, much as happened to the secured creditors in the GM and the Chrysler bailouts. President Obama's words, his actions, his agencies, his laws, I could go on and on and on and on to demonstrate the proposition that he is an anti-constitutionalist, but to what end? He's run his last race and his influence wanes each day. He may stop us in the Congress from passing good laws, but we can stop him from passing bad laws, which, as Coolidge said, is perhaps more important, particularly with this president in office. Even after he departs, though, his anti-constitutionalist spirit will remain. Think how deeply it pervades our government. Last year we learned, or maybe I should say we had our suspicions confirmed, that the IRS targets political opponents of the government for harassment and intimidation. What would be worse, though, if political appointees directed these abuses, or if career IRS employees simply share the attitude and don't need such direction? The EPA's regional administrator for my home state was caught on tape once, likening his enforcement actions to the Roman practice of crucifying innocent persons to tame the people as a whole. How many bureaucrats in our government share that belief? Nor is this limited to the executive branch. Disregarding the constitutional duty to their institutions, many of President Obama's legislative allies encourage his overreach. Nancy Pelosi has said it's fine for the president to circumvent Congress after he had, quote, exhausted legislative remedies. Likewise, Harry Reid shrugs at the prospects of unilateral executive action to achieve policy goals defeated in Congress. Reid says, quote, if the president decides to do it, I'd be in favor of it. So much for connecting, as Madison said, the interest of the man to the constitutional rights of the place to supply the defect of better motives. Though Harry Reid certainly doesn't lack for defective motives. Barack Obama may be the culmination of modern liberalism's anti-constitutionalist spirit, but it won't be the end of it, not unless we continue to work to end it. The federal government's regulatory apparatus will still violate the principles of the Declaration and the Constitution by granting unlimited authority to politically unaccountable officials who exercise legislative, executive, and judicial powers. Human beings being what we are, these arrangements can't help but lead to abuses. Remember Madison's admonition, men are not angels. And today's abuse of power will become tomorrow's precedent. We could change some of these arrangements in simple Madisonian ways. For instance, we might require an up or down vote of Congress on major regulations or a mandatory sunset on those regulations. We could rewrite regulatory laws to divest agencies of such vast and vague discretion of power, stripping the lowest learners of the government of their power to do harm to our fellow citizens. We could reform civil service laws to hold the lowest learners of the government accountable when they misbehave, rather than putting them on paid leave. But again, these internal checks are but auxiliary precautions, to use Madison's words. The ultimate safeguard is recourse to the people at the ballot box. Fortunately, big government is not popular with Americans, but the Constitution is. And I suspect the president and his allies are about to learn this lesson again, having forgotten it after a mere 4 years. For that, for the continued and enduring popularity of our Constitution and our founding principles, I want to thank you all for your efforts to preserve the veneration of our constitutional forms, without which Madison feared a free government cannot long endure. Thank you. God bless you. God bless our beloved country. Thank you. We have
time for a couple questions.
Couple of questions, comments, insults. Yes, sir.
Yes. Probably voted, I think you did vote for the RAINS Act, which requires that Congress approve major new federal regulations. But it's going to be hard to get 60 votes in the Senate for such a law, and it's hard to imagine a president signing a law that would give that much power away. There are a number of people, including Senator Ron Johnson, who talked about the idea that two-thirds of the states could actually force Congress to propose an amendment the same way that the states forced Congress to propose the Bill of Rights. There's an amendment out there called the Regulation Freedom Amendment, which would require congressional review if a quarter of the members of the House or the Senate objected. Do you have any thoughts on that idea of a constitutional amendment and the idea that states would force Congress to propose it?
Well, let me back up to the first premise of your question about the RAINS Act. It did pass the House. It's not going to pass Harry Reid's Senate because it's not even going to come up for a vote. But if we win the Senate, I wouldn't discount the possibility of a chastened Democratic minority, many of whom are up for re-election in 2016 under adverse political conditions, supporting that kind of very popular common sense measure. And then I'm not sure the president would sign it, but I'm not sure he would veto it either. I mean, this is a president, remember, who in November of last year, during the height of the insurance cancellation crisis, said, oh, those policies only apply to 5% of Americans. They're substandard, they're Wild West, they're unregulated. And within 3 weeks, then when the political pressure got too intense, he said, okay, you can keep your Wild West substandard unregulated policy. And that's the heart, that was the heart of his namesake legislation. Now, if he does veto it, that means it simply elevates the matter in the public mind and I think crystallizes an important debate for our 2016 nominee, as you saw happen in 2006 when the Democrats took office, and then they did so for the 2008 presidential elections. I'm not familiar with Senator Johnson's specific recommendation. I think the Article 5 convention process is at a minimum a good way to get Congress off of its duff and getting acting on something like the RAINS Act. And we do have a long history in this country of actions by the states moving towards a potential convention to generate action by the Congress on something like the RAINS Act. Any other questions? All right. Well, again, thank you for letting me come and kick off. Now that you've got the worst part behind you, you can move on to the very excellent panels of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Good luck out in the byways of Arkansas.